Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Ami Copeland, Executive Director of Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. We are pleased to welcome Lisa Allman and Pat Rizzi. Lisa is co-chair of the Unmanned Aircraft Systems Group at Hogan Lovells, and Pat Rizzi is counsel at the same firm. They are here to talk about the impact domestic drones could have on American businesses and the federal regulation of unmanned aircraft. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward is a national business organization that helps business leaders from across America brief Washington on how to create jobs and accelerate the economy. Over the past several years, we've helped tens of thousands of business leaders from across the country brief more than 450 senior administration officials, members of Congress, governors, mayors, and local elected officials. Before we get started, I'd like to go over a few housekeeping items. First, to foster a candid conversation, this call is off the record and not intended for press. Second, this will be an interactive phone briefing, and there will be time for you to ask your questions and share your comments after the remarks are made. You can participate in one of two ways. You can press 1 at any time to be entered into the queue to ask your question live, or you can email your question to info@businessfwd.org. Again, you can press 1 to be entered into the queue to ask your question live, or you can send your question via email to info@businessfwd.org. Please be sure to include your name, business, and location in your message if you email a question to us. If you are asking your question live, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. We'll get in as many questions as we can during this time. Okay, now let's get started. Please welcome Lisa Allman and Pat Rizzi.
Great. Thank you so much, Ami. And hi, everyone. It's great to be here with you today. And we're very excited to talk to you about a very newsworthy topic these days here in the U.S. and around the world, really. We're in the midst of drones fever. The technology has moved so quickly, and what used to be considered just a toy, we've been flying hobbyist model airplanes for recreational use for decades, is now actually a tool for industry and in public agencies. And for this reason, we're seeing incredible excitement from companies surrounding the use of drones for their operations. But also from a policymaking side, for all of us, concern about their safety and privacy implications. So the policymaking in this area, as in so many different areas, has fallen a bit behind the innovation. Technology is always moving more quickly than policy. And drones is the perfect example of this. There's nothing different here. But because of that, there's a lot of misinformation out there about what the rules are and some confusion about where the law and regulations are going. So we're very happy to be with you all today to talk with you about some of that and look forward to all of your questions and to having this be an interactive conversation. So we're going to talk first today about the growth of this industry and some of the numbers that just came out of the FAA this week that were pretty amazing, and about this week's registration news. This is a very timely call because we just got some big news out of the Department of Transportation this week about registration requirements moving forward for the use of drones. And then we're going to update on efforts related to finalizing the proposed rule and getting broadly authorizing commercial operations here in the United States, and what has to happen in order for us to get there. And then I'll close with a few thoughts on privacy and where I see some challenges to the industry in the years ahead. So first on the market projections, the bottom line here is that drones are coming, and that's a great thing. Of course, we do need rules in place, and those are there are rules in place, but not rules that will broadly authorize commercial operations. We're not there yet. But drones have enormous popularity because they enhance safety and efficiency for companies. If you're doing pipeline inspection, it makes a whole lot of sense to be able to do that with a drone. If you're inspecting your crops, it makes a whole lot of sense to be able to do that with a drone rather than with manned aircraft. They're safer to operate than manned aircraft, and they're much cheaper. Now, on the hobbyist side, because hobbyist use is broadly authorized right now, we'll just glance at the numbers quickly. There's clear exponential growth in sales in just a few short years. So prior to this year, prior to 2015, the FAA estimates that there were only 200,000 hobbyist drones here in the United States. Here in 2015, the FAA estimates that 1.6 million drones have been or will be sold to hobbyists. That's just for model aircraft, hobbyist recreational use. And 800,000 of those sales are expected to happen right around now, between now and the end of the year over the holiday season. FAA has projected that an additional 1.9 million model aircraft units will be sold in 2016, or small drones. 600,000 of those are expected to be used for commercial purposes once the rules around commercial operations are finalized. And sales for small drones used for commercial applications is expected to rapidly accelerate once we have a rule in place with different growth rates and different applications. But they're forecast to grow from very few small drones employed commercially today to nearly 11 million units by 2020, which is a huge leap and obvious exponential growth in this industry. So with this rapid growth in the drone market, we have lots of new drone owners and operators who are excited about their new toy, but they're not familiar with the rules surrounding the safety of the national airspace. And that's where I first want to just talk briefly about the news of the week, which was the registration rule that came out of the DOT on Monday. Because there are so many new drones here in the national airspace and so many new drone operators, we've seen lots of headlines involving careless operators misusing drones or crashes at stadium sporting events at the U.S. Open, for example. Some incidents we've seen reported a lot in the news involving close encounters between drones and manned aircraft. And everyone, including and perhaps even most of the UAS community, has been very upset about these irresponsible flyers, and so for this reason, Department of Transportation took steps to really enhance education and enforcement. So on Monday, the FAA published an interim final rule, essentially a rule that requires any drones weighing heavier than 250 grams, which is about half a pound, or in other words, as much as two sticks of butter would weigh. Anything between that and 55 pounds, you have to register on a new web-based registration system. Now, if you're a retailer offline, I'm happy to get you up to speed on all the rules around hobbyists, because we're talking today with our conversation today is about issues affecting the commercial industry. I'm going to stick with how these rules affect commercial operators and what we should be looking for. But this new online registration system is actually not yet available to commercial operators. March 31st, 2016, the FAA identified as the date when commercial operators would transition from registering in this very archaic paper-based registration system to a web-based system, online system, if they'd like. And the requirement will just be that each commercial operator will be required to register each individual drone, enter the drone-specific information as well as some other information, and pay a $5 registration fee per vehicle. And registration will last 3 years, and then there's a $5 registration fee for each renewal. So that's registration, which was big news this week. There was a lot of pushback, mostly from some hobbyist groups surrounding process issues surrounding the rule. But again, if you're interested in those subjects from a hobbyist perspective, I'm happy to have another conversation with you offline after this call. So moving on to the legal framework for actually using drones if you're a company. Right now, it's illegal to fly drones for any non-recreational purpose unless you have a special license from the FAA. The most common of these licenses is known as a Section 333 exemption. And I took a quick look through all the folks here on this call. I know some of you do have your own Section 333 exemption. That's fantastic. Essentially what you're doing is you're telling the FAA that you understand that your drone is an aircraft and that you have to abide by the federal aviation regulations, and these are the rules that don't make any sense for a drone operator to have to abide by. There's been high demand across the country for businesses to fly. As evidence, we have almost 3,000, more than 2,600 Section 333 petitions for exemption that have been approved by the FAA in areas everywhere from agriculture to inspections and insurance and news gathering, disaster response, delivery, oil and gas, and filmmaking, and more. Now, these Section 333 exemptions have been are a short-term solution, and they come with some important limitations. So, for example, the operator of the drone has to have a manned aircraft pilot's license. But once you have a 333, as long as you abide by these conditions and limitations, you can generally fly vehicles less than 55 pounds anywhere across the country, not in restricted airspace, within line of sight, away from people in congested airspace, and during the daytime hours. You have a blanket authorization to fly up to 200 feet, and you can get permission to fly up to 400 feet. But again, that's a piecemeal solution, and the FAA is working hard now to finalize its proposed rule, which it released February of this year, which will finally broadly authorize commercial UAS activity here in the national airspace. There's a lot of pressure to get this done quickly, but the FAA's mandate is to ensure the safety of the airspace, not to necessarily to promote innovation, and so there's a lot of different perspectives in that agency, and so there's a lot of conversations that have been going on behind the scenes. Now, industry was generally pleased with the direction of the rule, but it's pushing the FAA on a few areas, specifically with regard to beyond visual line of sight flights, flights over people, and night operations. It doesn't make any sense to fly a drone to inspect crops if you have to follow the drone every mile or so. For many of the applications, we need to be able to do these things, and the current iteration of the rule won't yet allow these things. Now, another issue to watch here is the micro-drones question. When it released the proposed rule, the FAA asked the public whether a micro-drone classification would make sense. This was based on the tiered approach, which is taken in Canada, which regulates differently based on the weight of the drone. And so does a 4-pound drone present a different risk to the national airspace than a 55-pound drone? I think a lot of people would agree with that proposition, and so that's something that policymakers are considering now, looking at what Canada has done in this area. Now, the next step in the rulemaking process is for the rule to get sent back to the White House. And once this happens, you'll all have a chance to comment or go meet with the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, who will be running an interagency process to review what's in the rule. It's really the last chance before the rule becomes final to give your opinion, so I think it's a good opportunity. That is expected in probably February. Right now, the goal is to release the rule by June, although I've heard recently that this could be moved to August, but the idea is sometime this summer we will have a final rule in place. There will be a White House interagency review process before that, and it's important for all of us to have our voices heard during that period. Now, that's on the safety and operational issues regarding to use of drones. If you're a policymaker, you also hear a lot from the American public about privacy concerns related to the use of drones. So I just want to spend just a few minutes talking about privacy issues. I'm sure you hear about this a lot in the news. On the one hand, a drone is just a platform for a camera, just like a satellite or a pole camera, for example, or a helicopter. But on the other hand, the American people perceive drones differently. And there are academic studies which ask Americans how they feel about a drone-mounted camera versus a ground-mounted camera capturing the same information and the same data. And people are largely just more concerned with the drone-mounted camera for one reason or another. So because of this, we're seeing local and state governments in many of your states across the country proposing all kinds of legislation and ordinances that would limit drone use in some way. So Chicago just passed one, New York City's considering some, Miami's looking at one, the California governor just vetoed some others. Almost every state in the country is looking at something of this sort. And I do see this as a big challenge for the industry moving forward, simply because a lot of them are based on some misinformation and misperceptions out there. Now, on the federal government side, the same day that the proposed safety rule, which we just talked about, was released by the FAA, the White House set up an interagency review process a multi-stakeholder process for private and commercial entities to craft some best practices for the commercial and private use of drones. This process is being led by the Department of Commerce, NTIA, National Telecommunications and Information Administration, where we've had several meetings, and this group seems to be coming to some consensus on some privacy rules that'll be voluntary best practices for the industry, which will be helpful, I think, with regard to this local and state legislation to provide a template that has buy-in from industry and privacy advocates alike. Now, there's a lot that I didn't have time to cover. I'd love to follow up with any of you offline about some of other things that are going on in the policymaking world around drones. Of course, you know, we need highways in the sky. NASA is working to design highways in the sky. There's action on the Hill. We're seeing a lot of state investment in drone efforts, which is great. The technology is moving quickly. And one thing that I'll end with is that we're actually about to launch what's known as the Commercial Drone Alliance to work on behalf of industry on many of these issues that industry cares about with respect to drones. So if that's something you're interested in, I'd be happy to talk to you about that as well. But with that, Ami, I'd love to just throw it open to any questions that folks might have.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Lisa. As Lisa just said, now we will open it up to your questions and comments. If you have a question, please press 1 to ask your question live, or you can email your question to info@businessfwd.org. Again, please remember to include yourself along with your business and where you are calling from. So again, please press 1 to ask your question live, or email your question to info@businessfwd.org. We're going to go to our first question to be asked live, and this is from Kenji Sugara. Kenji, the line is open.
Hi. So as stated, my name is Kenji Sugihara. I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm an Oregon Tourism Commissioner and also a member of an advisory group to the Oregon Legislature on UAS issues. So my question is, do you know whether the FAA is going to respond to the comments made to the FAA's interpretation of the special rule for model aircraft as required by UAS America Fund LLC versus the FAA? The latest November status report was a cut and paste from the previous status report. Or is the FAA going to wait for the publication of Part 107? For those who don't know, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals granted a motion for abeyance on the FAA's interpretation that in part says any operation not conducted strictly for hobby or recreation purposes could not be operated under the special rule for model aircraft.
Sure. So, yeah, thank you, Kenzie, for that question. It's a great question. I'm not sure. So, of course, the special interpretation of model aircraft was necessary when there were questions about the FAA's authority to regulate model aircraft. But it was actually in the context of a case about someone who flew a UAS in a way that recklessly endangered the public at the University of Virginia for commercial purposes. In that model special rule, the FAA issued just more guidance for the public on what a hobbyist use is versus what a commercial use is. I know that they were taking comments, and there's a bunch of litigation and other things going on right now surrounding it. I do think that right now the FAA is looking to publish rule Part 107, and taking all sorts of comments into consideration as it's doing so. For example, on this registration rule, if you read the preamble to the rule, it looked at comments both from that were issued in response to the request for comments to this rule, as well as comments that were issued in response to the NPRM in that public comment period. Pat, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I don't. I think whether or not the FAA keeps sort of issuing, as the questioner said, sort of a formalistic sort of status update pending the outcome of the final rule, I think is driven by a lot of different sensitivities involved here. But I have not heard of any further insight as to where the FAA's thinking is on the litigation vis-a-vis the pending rule for small UAS.
Great. Thank you both. We're going to go take our next question from submitted online, and this is from Mike Moserino from the W.S. Darley Company in Itasca, Illinois. And the question is, what about the public use category? Fire, police, etc. Will there be a streamlined system similar to commercial? They can't apply for Section 333 and need a COA to operate. Any chance of this changing?
It's a great question. So over the last few years, the FAA has somewhat streamlined the process for public operators, and that you there's a public COA process that you go through if you're a police or law enforcement agency or public agency wanting to use drones. And that was, they were kind of the public use category was one of the first categories considered in terms of aiming for broad authorization of the use of UAS. My understanding is that once the final, once Part 107 comes out, public users of UAS could also use that rather than and get their UAS operator certificate and go through that process, rather than have to go through the whole separate public COA process. There are different benefits to different things. So there are some public, so for, I've represented maybe 30 universities across the country, some of whom are public public universities. And the key there is if you're operating under a public COA, you can only do so for a core governmental function. But many of them ended up getting 333 exemptions or applying for 333 exemptions instead because it offered them more flexibility in different ways. And so, anyways, there will be some relief come Part 107, but the idea is that it should be somewhat streamlined. NIJ at DOJ is a good interface with local and state law enforcement, other or public agencies who are looking to use drones. So I'm happy to connect you with them if you have specific questions about that process.
Thank you. And for our next question, we're going to go to Kelly Mack here in Washington, D.C. Kelly, your line's open.
Great, thanks. So I work with a communications firm, and one of our clients is concerned with risk management. And I'm wondering if you could comment on any perspectives as far as that is happening on the government or policy side with managing drone risk.
Are you talking about kind of from the insurance perspective?
I think both insurance and public safety.
And public safety. So, right, that's a great question. So let me also, first on insurance, of course, insurance companies are very interested to use drones. They're also somewhat policymakers on the use of drones since they're pricing out created policies for their customers who are using drones. On the insurance side, it's still in very early stages, but there are some insurance companies who are some of them who have been aviation insurance companies for many years who are really taking the lead on being thought leaders in this area, and I'm happy to connect you with any of them. On the public agency side, I actually was going to talk about counter UAV efforts. In the interest of time, I had to cut that part of my remarks. So, but there's a lot of conversation right now going on around counter UAV policy and counter UAV technology, meaning rogue drones flying over my property. What can I do? What do we do about drones flying in the vicinity of airports? The FAA actually just announced a new Pathfinder program on counter UAV efforts in the vicinity of 5 miles of an airport with a company called Khaki. And they're doing research and development there to develop some best practices. There's technology out there that allows anyone to be able to detect, identify, and track rogue drones. The question is, what can you do, right? So I have a lot of companies that call me that are upset because they are very enthusiastic about the use of drones for themselves, but they're worried about others' use of drones over their property. And the question is, what can they do about it? And there are technology-neutral laws and rules that are in place, but they don't obviously help if you have a drone hovering over your property or you're not sure how to get rid of it. That is something that is on a policy level also. There are conversations that are happening now and processes that are happening now. I do think that a lot of this will end up being technological. There was just a recent news article earlier this week about Tokyo police using drones with nets to capture rogue drones. But there's a lot of conversations that are happening, but no specific answers at this point in terms of we've seen in states too where there's been legislation proposed that will authorize the shooting down of drones flying over my property. That's likely not a wise solution because obviously it increases other safety risks, but questions out there about whether there's something you can do with the spectrum that's necessary to fly the drone. What are some proposed solutions here? And these are definitely questions that are being considered by the government now, as well as on the private industry side. You know, we have a lot of technology out there. This is an issue that needs considering. And again, we can detect, identify, and track, but then what? And I know, you know, a lot of companies out there are trying to think of the proposed solutions in that space.
Thank you. We're going to go to our next question live, and this is from Frank Myers in Phoenix, Arizona. Frank, line's open.
Good afternoon there. I'm ex-air traffic controller for 9 years, both in military and civil international airports, and I just wonder if anybody has ever considered the enormous risk and the madness that is going on if all these things are going to fly around. It seems that it's naive to come up with an idea that registration and rules will solve the problem, because there is no way possible of enforcing these things. How is the police going to find out if a drone is above or below 400 feet, exceeds the speed limit, or its weight? There is nothing that transmits that information, and even if it did, if there are that many drones around, you need to have extremely sophisticated radar with a resolution that is beyond what we have today to identify which drone is which. So it is totally useless and naive to come up with all these rules and regulations if nobody has the ability to enforce it. There was a problem here in Phoenix where a drone was spotted at 5,000 feet, about I don't know how many miles away from the city of Phoenix, from the airport. So what is the police going to do at 5,000 feet? They can't stop it. They cannot take the driver out. They cannot ask the people to shut off the engine. So,
yeah.
Great.
Is there anything going on that makes any sense?
Okay. Thank you, Frank, for that question. It's an important question, and of course one we covered briefly at the top, but you're right, registration doesn't get it, irresponsible flyers flying at 5,000 feet, and it's a clear concern. And this is something that policymakers are juggling, where how do we take advantage of the many benefits of drones, but in a way that also ensures the safety of the public. So I have some thoughts here. I know Pat does as well, so I'll turn it over to Pat first and then come back to me.
Well, I think, Frank, you raised some very good issues related to the safety of these things, and as Lisa said, it's always a cost-benefit trade-off. I mean, even in manned aircraft operations for certification of aircraft or of procedures around airports, there's always a risk-benefit trade-off. And so in this particular case, you're right that the FAA at some level is starting out with what I'll call low-hanging fruit, like trying to get people to register, which, as you point out, will not in and of themselves stop somebody. And indeed, the FAA recognized that, because the FAA only has so many people and resources, and so they have issued guidance to local law enforcement as to the type of information that they would like local law enforcement to obtain if people report these incidents, if you will, of improperly or allegedly improperly flown UASs, et cetera. And the FAA in that regard has issued like a 12-page guidance book to law enforcement, because the FAA doesn't have the inspectors or the investigators sufficient to cover the waterfront in this area. And so you're right that there is a long way to go on this. The NASA and others are looking to develop low altitude air traffic management and control systems that will focus on UAS and hopefully bring some of the information that, as you rightly pointed out, is now lacking, bring some of that information based on manned aircraft operations to unmanned aircraft operations at low altitudes, but there remains a long way to go. And the last point I would just raise, which Lisa will mention as well, is that we have certain technologies out there right now that are embedded in some of these UAS vehicles with regard to no-fly zones and things like that, that are an incremental step. It doesn't get us there, but it's an incremental step towards addressing some of these unfortunate incidents that people have heard about, like Phoenix or Houston, you know, near the approach path and things like that.
Yeah, and just a little bit more on that technology. I mean, DJI, the biggest drones manufacturer in the world, recently, in the wake of the White House drone incident where the drone landed on the White House lawn, is now voluntarily incorporating geofencing technology into all of its drones sold on the market today. So that means, so for example, I live in Washington, D.C. I can't even fly my DJI drone here in D.C. if I tried. You can't even take off. And so you can imagine how helpful this will be, that you can't fly higher than 400 feet. You can't fly within 5 miles of an airport. This technology will help get us some of the way there. But, of course, you know, someone with a homemade drone that they want to fly at 5,000 feet, we need some additional measures in order to be able to find them. And these are very few people, very few irresponsible operators, but, of course, it's of very high concern to the community.
Good point. Thank you. Our next question is going to be from Lisa Christopher in Buffalo, New York. Lisa, your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling from, we are an environmental consulting company, and I actually don't have a major question. I just wanted to go back up to when you were discussing about beyond the visual sight was going to be changing.
Yep.
You mentioned three things, and I missed it.
And where industry was concerned with the proposed rule was on a few different items. First, beyond visual line of sight, being able to fly farther than I can see with my naked eye, which the rule does not currently allow for. Being able to fly in congested areas or near people, so like you can imagine realtors looking to fly in suburbs, news gatherers looking to cover breaking news, construction companies looking to be able to fly in their sites, want to be able to fly within 500. Right now the 333 exemption condition would be within 500 feet laterally of people. The first version of this proposed rule wouldn't allow you to fly within near people either, and that's something that industry is concerned about. If certain safety steps are taken, would they be able to fly closer to people, incorporating some of these technologies like collision avoidance technology, for example. And then nighttime flights. So, for example, being able to inspect wind turbines, a lot of that can be done very effectively in the evening. There's a lot of folks that are looking to be able to fly at night for various purposes. And those are the three different the three policy areas where industry is pushing pretty hard on the FAA to consider some of the new technologies that are out there and try to move the policymaking forward.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question is going to be from Jason Carr in Seattle, Washington. Jason, your line's open.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Yep.
Great. I did come into the conversation a bit late, so I do apologize if my questions have already been answered. I have two quick questions for you. Will a pilot license always be required to leverage the capabilities of a UAS under 5 to 10 pounds for commercial survey mapping in remote, non-populated areas away from restricted airspace? That's question number one. Question number two, is there a need for a pilot license if you operate on Native American lands, if you have consent to operate on Native American lands? Thank you.
Okay, I'll answer the first. I'll let Pat answer the second. On the first, on the pilot's license question, with regard to are they always going to be required, so right now, in order to operate under a 333 exemption approval from the FAA, you do need to have some sort of manned aircraft pilot's license. That can be a sports or recreational pilot's license. It doesn't have to be a full private pilot's license, but you do have to have flown a manned aircraft and be certified to do so. That will not always be the case. Once Part 107, once this new rule becomes final, assuming that it hasn't changed from the form in which it was proposed, it will allow for a new process in place that where you go take a knowledge test and you get your UAS operator certificate. You apply for and get your UAS operator certificate. You just submit a bunch of information, take a test, and soon after you can be approved and certificated to fly. So that is obviously very different from the manned aircraft context, but that was where, under this 333 exemption process, that context was starting. On the Native American question, I'll turn it over to Pat.
So your second question had two parts. So the airspace is of the United States is under the jurisdiction of the FAA. So there's no real carve-out that this airspace would somehow be immune from these regs just because of their particular location. The second part of your question was whether, you know, even if you could somehow consent out of that. And the answer to that is, with respect to these regulatory provisions that we're talking about, when that final rule comes out, the regulatory provision will state what the pilot requirement will be. The proposed rule talked about you need to have a UAS operator certificate, which you will get when you complete an aeronautical subject matter test. If that is the rule, it is the rule, and no person on the ground can consent to you flying over them even if you don't have it. In other words, a private person cannot consent you out of complying with the federal regulations. Now, if the regulations have a carve-out that say, unless you get consent, as in the case of flying over people's property, if you get their consent. But private parties can't say, oh yeah, if you're flying over me, it's fine, don't worry what the FAA says.
Our next question is going to be from Michael Corman in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Michael, your line's open.
Hi, thanks so much for this. I'm Mike Corman. I've actually been a drone entrepreneur in the Twin Cities and working on my manned pilot's license. I have a question that I think people are very reluctant to ask. And when I speak with companies about the requirements for pilot's licenses and whatnot, I often talk to construction companies about risk. To me, the worst possible scenario and the biggest risk, obviously, is the downing of a manned aircraft, whether it's a small general aviation aircraft or a large commercial aircraft. I'd love your insights, especially given that you're in Washington. What would the FAA do if something like that happened, let alone what the American public would do?
Well, that would obviously be a catastrophe. I think your question involved kind of risk management. I have talked to many insurance companies on this point in particular. That's what an insurance company insuring someone to fly drones, what they're most concerned about, of course, is that something catastrophic happens. And I don't, especially right now, a lot of people, you know, if you have your 333 exemption, you're operating in accordance with the rules, that wouldn't happen, right, because you're staying under 400 feet and away from airports. So assuming you're violating the law in some way, the insurance folks that I've talked to have said that that's not something that would be covered. Now, that doesn't say that the situation – that's for you to understand as a business owner. But of course, that would be a catastrophe, you know, for everyone, and policymakers would grapple with that. Pat, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think – it's hard to prognosticate what would happen in one of those cases, but yeah. I think you're right that is among the worst case scenarios here. And when you have an emerging industry as the UAS industry is, you have to be very careful because big missteps get magnified even more. And I think if you had an incident like that, I think it would depend, first of all, on the context. So, for example, if it was that the manned aircraft wasn't doing something properly but the UAS operator was, that would be a different story than if you have a UAS that was operating above its altitude near an airport without talking to the FAA, or if you had a UAS that basically broke through its geofence and other safeguards and had a flyaway incident that then brought down a big airliner. And in those cases, I think the public policymakers would look at ratcheting up enforcement and maybe bearing down on limiting who has the operational capability to operate the UAS until things were ironed out in many respects. Because if that happened, for example, with a commercial airliner, you have now just poked the bear of some very big lobbying groups here in town, including the A4A, which is formerly the Air Transport Association, which represents most of the major cargo and passenger airlines here. the pilots union, ALPA, which is the biggest pilots union, has already been at the forefront of yelling, go slow with this. And those groups would bring the house down if something like that happened.
I would also just note that there are some, and Canada actually does require liability insurance, and some states and localities are requiring that. FAA has not to this point, or there has not been a requirement for operators here in the U.S. to have insurance, but some states and localities seem to be considering that. Enforcement efforts also have really stepped up. So I don't. There was recently a lot of coverage on the Skypan group, who was a drones aerial photography company, taking photos, having a website, active company up and running that was using drones for aerial photography, and they were flying in New York City and in Chicago, including near LaGuardia Airport and within 5 miles of an airport. And of course, the FAA levied or has suggested a $1.9 million fine against them. And, you know, largely because the operations were near people and also near airports. So the FAA is definitely stepping up its enforcement efforts. I think from what I've seen, there have been about 20 enforcement actions, I think is what they said recently. And so they're definitely looking to ramp that up.
Great, thank you. And we're going to take our final question from Ken Dunlap in McLean, Virginia. Ken.
Hi, thanks very much. Lisa, you mentioned a little bit about the Commercial Drone Alliance. I'm just kind of interested in what's the breadth of membership with the alliance? What kind of gaps in regulatory rulemaking are you trying to address, and maybe what the overall vision of the group is?
Yeah. Thanks for the question, Ken. So the Commercial Drone Alliance will be launched formally after the first of the year. It's going to be a kind of variety of businesses, companies who are interested in the commercial drones market. There are a few advocacy organizations that are out there, but that are working on hobbyist issues or that are working on the defense side. And they're really, we've seen a gap on the commercial drone industry side. And so we're forming this group in response to the demand for such an alliance. We're going to be focusing on, for example, with regard to the rule, the three areas where I mentioned, which is flights beyond line of sight, flights near people, congested areas, night flights. We're going to be working on bringing innovators and policymakers together so that we can be incorporating new technologies into future rulemakings, participating in this rulemaking, as well as on the privacy side, engaging on that in that conversation, and working on all of the state and local legislation and ordinances that are being proposed that will limit drone use by commercial operators. We'll be targeting those as well. So I'd be happy, Ken, to talk to you offline about that and send you more information. I think you know how to reach me, but Ami can also connect us.
Absolutely. So again, that's all we have time for today. Please check your emails for a post-event survey where you can let us know what you thought of today's call. We'll also include resources about where you can learn more information about federal regulations of unmanned aircraft, how to get in touch with our expert speakers today, and then we'll also be sending out an email to anyone who RSVP'd for this call regarding the announcement of the Commercial Drone Alliance next year. So you can keep your eyes open for that announcement, and we will help them let folks know. So again, we'd like to thank everyone for joining the call today. A special thank you to Lisa and to Pat and to everyone who was able to make it. We look forward to working with you all again soon. Happy holidays, and have a great day. Thank you.